A production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Senate Tax Committee. And we'd have the secretary please read the roll.
Senator Adelstein. Senator Howey.
Here.
Senator Gerstad.
Here.
Senator Maher. Senator Merchant.
Here.
Senator Nelson.
Here.
Senator Peterson.
Here.
Senator Frisley?
Here.
Senator Hansen?
Here.
Have a quorum.
Quorum is present. Thank you. Motion would be in order to approve the minutes.
So moved.
Moved by Merchant, seconded by Nelson. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. I would once again remind those of you who are here, especially to be attentive, if you have a cell phone, please turn it off or make it so it doesn't make noise. And we will be hearing a few bills, and those of you who are here to present testimony on the bills, I would ask that you be sure and sign in to registry back by the door so that we can, most important, to get your name spelled right as they go into the official minutes. The first order of business this morning will be to continue our report from the Department of Revenue and Regulations. And remember that at our last meeting, we heard the report on property taxes. And some of the other important functions of the Department of Revenue, of course, are our sales tax, contractors' excise tax. So with that in mind, I would welcome Jan Talley to the microphone to tell us all the things that we want to know and maybe a few things that we don't even want to know.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Jan Talley, South Dakota Department of Revenue and Regulation. I'm here today to talk a little bit about what our division does and our various duties and the taxes that we collect. I'll go through a short presentation here, and then there'll be a chance for questions when I get done. First of all, a division overview. We are responsible for administering the sales, use, contractors' excise tax, the municipal taxes, special jurisdictions, the tourism tax, the telecommunication gross receipts tax, and also the motor vehicle leasing tax. As a division, we collect all that information on our tax returns, and we either disperse it to, like, the special jurisdictions or the municipalities. Some of our other duties dealing with that is we issue tax licenses for sales, use, contractors, excise tax. We conduct licensee reviews, work on various compliance issues. When I'm talking about compliance issues, we're dealing with unlicensed taxpayers that come into the state of South Dakota. We find those businesses and bring them into compliance. We collect taxes for special events. A special event could be any fair in any county in South Dakota. We collect taxes at the Sturgis Rally, the State Fair. A lot of the major special events in South Dakota, we have a presence, we have an office set up there to collect the sales taxes. We operate a toll-free taxpayer service line. We handle approximately 32,000 calls in a year into that toll-free number. Businesses can call in with questions on billing notices, tax returns, any questions they might have for the department. And those calls are either transferred to our division, to our phone center, or to the various divisions in revenue. We're also responsible for implementing the streamlined sales tax project directives. And Jane Page, the deputy director of the division, will be speaking to the streamlined sales tax agreement and give you some information on that a little bit later. The chart that's up there next lists some of the major taxes that we collect. As you can see, sales tax is the bulk of our collections. Municipal tax is right along second, and then excise tax. And then we have some other various taxes that we collect with different amounts. This chart just gives you an idea of the impact of the sales tax at 65% of our collections. When you're looking at city sales tax and contractors' excise tax. I'll give you a little bit of history of the sales tax and how it applies. Sales tax is applied to the retailer's gross receipts from all sales of tangible personal property and service and all products transferred electronically, unless those products are specifically exempt. And a lot of the exemptions that we deal with are limited to, like, sales to the state and political subdivisions, certain agricultural products. We don't tax the sale of livestock or feed in South Dakota. Motor vehicles are not subject to sales tax. They're subject to vehicle excise tax. Motor fuel is subject to the fuel tax, so we don't collect sales tax on that. Labor on construction projects is subject to the contractor's excise tax. And then prescription drugs and health services we do not tax. We have a very broad-based sales tax. We tax a lot of property and services. We're one of the few states that tax a lot of services. The sales tax was implemented in 1935 with a tax rate of 2%. It increased to the current rate of 4% way back in 1969. So there has not been a lot of changes, rate changes. We had a couple of rate changes. One was dealing with economic development that was in effect for a while, and also one to purchase a railroad. Other than that, our sales tax has stayed at 4%. Exempt transactions. Sales for resale are exempt from sales tax. When a business purchases an item that they're going to be reselling, when they initially purchase that item, it's not subject to sales tax. There's exempt product and services. I talked about some of those with ag products and health services. Sales to governmental entities. When the state purchases equipment, they do not pay sales tax on it. When a school purchases equipment, they do not pay sales tax on it. Sales to nonprofit charitable hospitals. Most of the hospitals in South Dakota are nonprofit charitable. Those hospitals, when they purchase items, do not have to pay sales tax. Now, if they're a for-profit hospital or a clinic or something like that, they need to pay sales tax. Sales to accredited educational institutions are exempt from sales tax. That's like the state universities. Sales to relief agencies. Relief agencies are agencies that have applied for a specific exemption with the department. That exemption deals with, they provide services to the poor and distressed. And an example of that would be like a food bank that provides services to the poor and distressed. Their purchases are exempt from sales tax. And out-of-state deliveries. If a retailer sends items out-of-state, delivers items into Minnesota, those are not subject to South Dakota sales tax. Use tax. Use tax applies when sales tax is not properly charged. A lot of people do not understand use tax. A lot of people today purchase items over the internet. If the internet person does not charge you sales tax, you actually owe use tax on that. A lot of the retailers that you deal with on the internet are not licensed in our state because they don't have nexus in our state, so they do not collect sales tax. If you go out of state and purchase an item and bring it back into the state, and you have not paid sales tax on it, you owe use tax on it. It applies to the selling or purchase price, including freight or delivery. The use tax pertains to a lot of out-of-state contractors that come into our state, bring materials into our state that they haven't paid tax on. When they bring those materials into the state for a project here in South Dakota, they owe use tax on them. Purchases for resale are exempt from use tax. So if a retailer purchases an item for resale, they don't have to pay use tax on it. But if the retailer uses that item, consumes or uses that item in their business, it's a supply type item, they would owe use tax on that. Excise tax. Excise tax is a unique tax to South Dakota and one other state. It's a 2% tax on the contractor's gross receipts for realty improvements. There's a lot of misunderstanding on the contractor's excise tax. We deal with a lot of out-of-state contractors that come into the state and do not understand the excise tax. They don't have that type of tax in their state, and it's unusual when they come into South Dakota that they have to pay the tax, so we're dealing with a lot of unlicensed contractors. The tax includes, its gross receipts includes labor, material, profits, and taxes. So it's a 2% tax on the contractor's gross receipts. It's different than the sales tax. The prime is responsible to pay the 2%. Any subcontractor from the prime does not pay the 2%. The prime issues them a prime contractor's exemption certificate. So only the prime pays the 2%. Contractors, when I talked before about use tax, contractors owe use tax on materials. Any materials that they purchase without the sales tax on it, they owe the use tax. Contractors buy a lot of materials from out of state. They come into our state and there's no tax on them, so they owe the use tax. The excise tax was implemented in 1979 with a rate of 4%, and it decreased to its current rate of 2% in 1984. Another part of the excise tax is what we call the alternate excise tax. The alternate excise tax is a 2% rate on any work done for a qualified utility. If you look at your presentation there, I've listed the qualified utilities. So if a contractor does a project for a municipal utility, that would fall under the alternate excise tax. The difference with the alternate excise tax is both primes and subs pay excise tax on their gross receipts. So that's different than the regular excise tax where they issue the certificate. Neither the primes nor subs may deduct any amounts paid to others from their gross receipts. Again, use tax is due on owner-furnished materials and any materials that they bring in. Use tax is also due on owner-furnished materials provided by exempt entities. So if they're working for an exempt entity like a municipality, and the municipality provides some materials to that contractor, the contractor actually owes use tax on those materials. Owner-furnished materials under the alternate excise tax are not included in the contractor's gross receipts. So that's different than the regular excise tax where it includes everything. Under the alternate excise tax, there is no prime contractor exemption certificates because both primes and subs pay the tax. Overview of municipal taxes. We deal with currently 229 communities in South Dakota have a municipal tax, and this is in addition to state tax. Municipalities can impose up to a 2% general rate, and they can also impose a 1% municipal gross receipts tax. And that 1% is on alcoholic beverages, eating establishments, lodgings, ticket sales, or admissions to places of amusement. So a lot of our time is spent in the Department of Revenue dealing with municipalities. We collect the tax on all the tax returns, and then we disperse it to the municipalities. So we're dealing with a lot of tax rates. We're dealing with the municipal gross receipts tax. A lot of questions from municipalities. Tax collection agreements. We currently have five of the nine tribal governments within the state have tax collection agreements with us. They're listed there on your presentation. These tribes impose like tribal sales use tax, tribal contractors excise tax, cigarette tax, motor fuel tax, and these taxes would be identical to the state tax. We collect them on the tax returns under a separate tax code for that special jurisdiction. With those reservations that we have agreements with, those special jurisdictions, sales to both Indians and non-Indians are taxed. Construction refund programs. Another part of our duties is dealing with the large construction refund projects. There's various programs within revenue that an owner of a project can apply for a construction refund. It could be on an ag processing facility, which would be like an ethanol plant, or it could be on a new business facility like a manufacturing plant or possibly a wind farm. Those businesses can apply to the department for a refund, and the refunds, each program is handled a little bit differently. For instance, on the ag processing, they can get a refund on the just use tax paid on the ag processing equipment and the contractor's excise tax. So we deal with a lot of different businesses there that they actually pay the tax to the state on the tax returns. and then we process refunds to them. They file them quarterly or monthly, the refunds, and so the tax is refunded to them. The division has monitored and processed 36 refunds totaling more than $23.9 million since 2005. Total refund payments for FY08 were $14.8 million. Other division duties. We also do, our division handles licensee reviews. A licensee review is similar to a mini audit. The agent goes in, contacts the business, possibly looks at one tax return or a couple tax returns, and goes over the records of the taxpayer and possibly finds issues that the taxpayer may have. And then they're asked to file self-audit worksheets. It's a lot different than an audit. In an audit, you review all the records of the taxpayer. With a licensee review, we're just looking at a snapshot in time. And the taxpayer files the amended returns. On the presentation there, I show that we've done 731 reviews and then the collections for that area. Compliance checks. Talked a little bit about that earlier. We deal with a lot of unlicensed businesses. People come into the state, do not understand their sales tax or excise tax liabilities, and our agents find these people, bring them into compliance, get them licensed, and usually have them file back returns. We've worked on approximately a little over 2,700 cases in FY08 and collected about $1.5 million in that area. Special events, I talked a little bit about that. We spend a lot of time in the summer dealing with special events. We're usually present at any fair or any event in any county in the state of South Dakota. We really have a presence at like the state fair and the Sturgis Rally. We set up a tax collection office during those events and collect sales tax from those vendors. Most of the vendors in those areas are possibly from out of state and don't understand their tax obligations in South Dakota. So we have a physical presence in those areas. And we've collected from the top five events about $1.4 million in FY08. And that is the end of my presentation. I will stand by for questions.
Okay, I think that, let's see, why don't we hear from
Jane first?
Jane,
okay.
With regard to the sales tax, or the, especially the streamline, and then we'll hear questions from either or both of you.
Okay. Next up will be Jane Page. She's the deputy director for our division.
Morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Jane Page, Department of Revenue and Regulation. In your packets that you were given last week was this hard copy, and if you brought it back with you, you can follow through. Otherwise, I'll have the PowerPoint. And just to give you a little bit of background, the Federal Commerce Clause does not allow a state to register anyone in the state for sales tax unless they have a physical presence. That physical presence is called Nexus, N-E-X-U-S. And a physical presence is someone that has a store or a warehouse in the state, or they may have a salesman come through the state to find clients and visit with clients, or they can send a repairman into the state to repair equipment that someone has purchased. It has to be some sort of physical presence. But so many people are buying things over the internet, or years past bought them through catalogs, and states have always wanted to know, is there a way we can create nexus with those types of companies? There are lots and lots of taxes nationally. 45 states plus the District of Columbia have a sales tax. And on top of that, there's over 7,000 local jurisdictions. South Dakota alone has over 225 municipalities that have a tax, plus we have the reservation taxes. And again, retailers are only required to collect the tax if they have a physical presence in the state. If they don't have a physical presence and you purchase something over the internet or through a catalog and you're not charged tax, you owe the use tax, as Jan Talley talked about. So the streamlined project has a lot to do with use tax. it's much easier for us to collect tax from one retailer than from their 5,000 customers who maybe purchased a $30 item and owe $1.80 in tax. So that's what states are trying to do. Back in the early 90s, several states got together and decided, you know, we're going to challenge something here. There's a business in Massachusetts called Quill, and they sell office supplies, and they were selling a lot of them all over the country. And they sent a lot of their catalogs into the state. So the states were wondering if sending those catalogs into the state could possibly create a nexus situation. So they got together, and North Dakota agreed to take it to challenge them. And it went all the way to the United States Supreme Court because this was an interstate commerce situation. The Supreme Court in 1992 said, no, that's not enough for nexus in your state, but you can always ask Congress to change the law. So the states went to Congress and said, will you change the law so that we can maybe get some of these sellers licensed? And Congress said, look at all this stuff you have. There's over 7,000 taxing jurisdictions. Every state has more than one tax rate. Every city has more than one tax rate. The states tax things that the cities don't. The cities tax things that the state doesn't. Plus the administration of it, you had to send an application into every individual state. It was just a nightmare and a burden. And that's what the Commerce Clause says. You can't have a burden on interstate commerce. So they said, why don't you states get together and try to streamline all of this? And if you do, we'll look at changing the law. But some of the things that are at stake are, again, it's too complex, but also we're trying to level the playing field with the local merchants. The local merchants in South Dakota, they're paying property tax, they're employing people in the state, they're paying the unemployment tax, yet all these people are buying things outside the state now. So the local people, plus paying the sales tax, are somewhat at a disadvantage because those outside the state are not paying any of this tax. And there are significant losses of revenue to the state with all the out-of-state sales. The University of Tennessee has done a study of what they think states are losing with electronic commerce. And this was, it's being updated now, but for fiscal year 2008, they thought that nationally $21 to $33 billion were not being collected in use taxes. And for South Dakota, the projection for state and local tax was $56 to $88 million. So those are large numbers. So the goals of Streamlined were to create a simpler system for administering the taxes, where something couldn't be made simpler, make it uniform, balance the interest of a state's sovereignty with the interests of simplicity and uniformity, and then leverage the use of technology. And I can tell you, 10 years ago, we would not have been able to do this. The technology has advanced to the point now that a lot of this can be done. So in 2000, the states got together and started working on an agreement where they would come up with several items that a state had to meet. And the Congress said if you get at least 10 states representing 20% of the population who have complied with all those items in the agreement, then we will look at introducing a federal bill. In 2002, the agreement was set, and the provisions included simplification for administration. The state had to administer all the taxes, and we've always done that in South Dakota, but some states you sent a tax return to the city and a separate one to the state. In this case, you have to send everything to the state on one tax return. Uniformity, we have several definitions now that any state wants to use that definition, uses that definition, they have to use this definition. In technology, we have some we have one sales tax application now that you can go in and fill out, and you hit a button, and it is electronically sent out to all the streamlined states, and then balancing the interests of the state sovereignty. 13 states, by October 1st, 2005, 13 states, and South Dakota was one of them, had met all the items in that agreement. Today there are 19, and we're called a full member state. Today there's 19 full member states. And there's three associate member states. The difference between the full member and the associate is the associate has passed everything in the agreement, but they have a future effective date. It might not go into effect until July 1st, 2009, and once it does, then they'll become a full member state. This is the map of all the states. All the green ones are the full member states. The three pink ones are the associate member states. There's five states in white that don't have a sales tax, so they don't participate. The ones in orange are states that are working towards implementing their laws. They're not there yet, but they're working towards it. There's three in yellow. Their legislatures are not on board yet, but there are someone from those states who always comes to the streamline meetings, so they're keeping on top of it. Colorado is the only state that's not participating. They're not participating because they do have city administration of their taxes, like the city of Denver. If you're doing business in Colorado and in Denver, you have to apply for your city tax license and your state tax license. You send a return to the city and another to the state. The city can audit you. The state can audit you. So there is no state-level administration there, and at this point, they're not interested in changing that. So some of the key features of the SSUTA is a streamlined sales tax, sales and use tax agreement. So there's state-level administration. The state has to administer all the states. Rate simplification, you can only have one state rate. The cities can only have one city rate. A few years ago, we did have to change that in South Dakota. We had a 3% rate on ag equipment and a 4% rate on everything else. We changed that so that the ag equipment is now at the same rate at 4%. But to offset that, the legislature exempted parts and repairs for ag equipment, so it was more revenue neutral for them. And it did allow for the first 12 months the state was a full member, an out-of-state company could register and not have to pay any back taxes to the state. So it was a little hook to get people, because right now it's just a voluntary system. Another key features, you have to have a common state and local tax base. In other words, if the state taxes it, the city has to tax it. If the city taxes it, the state has to tax it. Uniform sourcing rule, and that means where does the tax apply? And South Dakota is destination-based, and so that means if you're in Pierre and you call a business in Sioux Falls and order something and you have it delivered to Mitchell, the state tax applies, but which city tax applies? Mitchell, because that's the destination of the item being sold. That has changed a little bit and streamlined. I'll get into that in just a moment. Then uniform sourcing rules for the other three, telecommunications, lease and rental, and direct mail. These are the definitions that are now uniform. If any state, full member state wants to use any of these definitions, they have to use the streamlined definitions. And this took a long, long time for all the states to agree on these definitions, but this was a huge hurdle, and it was the business community is thrilled that we have common definitions now. We don't use the term food in any of our statutes, but several states do exempt food, and they all had a different definition of food. And so a business that did business in several states just had a really difficult time. And the same with clothing. Every state that used the term clothing in their statute had a different definition. So this was instrumental in simplifying and unifying things across the country. And this has never been done before since sales tax started in South Dakota in the 30s, and I'm not sure how far back other states started. States have never gotten together like that, this to uniform and simplify the tax. There's a uniform treatment of bank holidays, uniform rules for sales tax holidays, uniform drop shipment rule, and bad debt and credit rule. Again, I talked about the central registration system. There is one registration system. There is one electronic tax return businesses can use. It's the same return for all the states. Uniform exemption certificate, a uniform rounding rule. As of December 31st, 2008, 1,189 businesses without a physical presence in South Dakota had registered. Keep in mind, they might not all be doing business in South Dakota. When they registered, it registered them automatically in all 19 states. They may only be doing business right now in maybe 10 of those states, not all 19, but they are registered with us anyway. The state tax, we put the state tax in a restricted trust fund, and that it also generates interest. There's around $2.7 million in that trust fund right now. It can't be spent by statute. We did add about $55,000 more in interest to it just in the last few weeks after I prepared this presentation. And the municipal tax, we've collected a little over $1.2 million. That's sent back to the cities immediately. current issues that we're having at Streamline. We're always having issues at Streamline. We're always bringing up new things to add to the agreement. And one of them was sourcing the tax, like I discussed a minute ago about destination sourcing. We had some very large states like Texas and Ohio. In their state, they use origin-based sourcing. In other words, they would always tax the sale from the store where the sale took place, not where the item was delivered. They did that only within their state. If it was sold out and delivered outside the state, they would use destination sourcing. And these states had decided it was politically unfeasible for them to get into Streamlined if they had to go to destination sourcing because it would cause such a revenue shift for their communities, their counties, and their cities. So we did put an amendment in the agreement that if you were an origin state, you could continue to use origin sourcing within your state. There's a couple restrictions to it, but they decided that was one item that we were just going to have to put through. Current issues that will affect South Dakota are replacement taxes. Taking something out of the sales tax and putting it in another chapter of the code so that Streamline wouldn't apply to it. Because Streamline only applies to sales taxes. We did that with the agricultural equipment. The legislature decided they didn't want municipal tax to apply to agricultural equipment. Well, we would have been out of compliance with Streamlined if we had exempted it from the sales tax, from the municipal sales tax. So what the legislature did is they took it out of sales tax and they put it into another chapter and just have a 4% tax on it. Now, that North Dakota also did that, and the Streamline community wasn't too upset about that. That was fine, but they've since gone in and said if there's any defined term in Streamlined, you cannot take that out of Streamline and replace it with another tax. You will be out of compliance if you do that. And they're also looking at other things, too. So that's something that you need to be aware of if you decide, I want to do something different with this item that's currently in sales tax, and I don't want to have to follow the Streamline rules. I'll just take it out of sales tax. What the business community is worried about is that pretty soon no state will have a sales tax anymore. They've moved everything out into something else so they don't have to be in conformity. We've not had any other issues with this. It's just something in the future to keep in mind. So the federal legislation, in the last couple years, the federal government has introduced a bill in Congress. It takes a long time to get things passed through Congress. Last year was one of the better years. They actually had hearings on the bill. All three of our South Dakota delegations signed on as co-sponsors of the bill. It did not pass. They didn't have enough people. This year it's not been introduced yet, but it's just the beginning of their congressional session, so we expect it to be introduced again. We don't expect it probably will pass this year either. It may take another couple of years. One of the sticking points is they don't want the small businesses to have to be pulled into this. If you sell, you know, $50,000 worth of items, should you have to come under all the qualifications of Streamlined? So they're putting a small business threshold in the Streamlined legislation, and right now it's $5 million. So if you had less than $5 million in gross sales, you wouldn't have to comply with it. There's a lot of businesses who think that's too high. There's a lot of other people who think it's too low. So right now the governing board has a task force where they're looking at all sorts of different things to help the federal government decide what the threshold should be in this bill. And that'll take a little bit longer to determine. We have Streamline meetings 3 to 4 times a year. There's two legislators on the and one person from the Department of Revenue who are the delegates to Streamline. I'm the Department of Revenue's delegate. Right now, Representative Dennert is a delegate. Senator Schmidt and McCracken and Representative Wick were delegates, but they're no longer here at the legislature, so I know we're waiting for the leadership to appoint some new people as delegates to Streamline. There's lots of other organizations that support Streamline. Of course, there's some businesses that don't support it because they just don't want to have to do it. That's my take on it. But this is something that has never been tried before. It's something that couldn't have been done before because the technology wasn't there to help with it. But I think it's something that needs to be done because of the way people purchase things now and purchase them through e-commerce. And that's my presentation. And I'll stand by for questions, so if you want Jan to come back up or however you want to do this.
Yes, please. I think, Jan, if you'd like to come back up, and if there's, I assume there might be some questions. Senator Gerstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have three questions, and whoever wants to take a crack at it, go right ahead here. I noticed that nursing or at hospitals, nonprofit hospitals, were exempted from the sales tax. So then I'm wondering why nonprofit nursing homes are not exempted. That's my first question.
Go ahead.
Jan Talley, Department of Revenue and Regulation. I'll take that question. The law specifically exempts the nonprofit hospitals but does not exempt the nursing homes. That's the reason for that.
Thank you for that answer. I kind of presumed that, but, you know, just checking in. I also have to make an observation, and I don't know if any, either of you would care to respond, but I find it interesting that chicken food is exempt, but baby food is not, and, you know, the whole ramifications of that issue. That was a comment, Mr. Chair. Sorry about that.
I assumed that to be the case, yes.
but I do have a question about uniformity, and maybe I heard this wrong, that ag machines are to be uniform are taxed at 4%. And then if that is the case, I guess my question is, and of course you're going to answer it's the law, but in terms of uniformity, I believe we have quite a category of machinery such as cars, boats, RVs, snowmobiles, planes, hot air balloons, and so on, that are taxed at 3%. And so is there some kind of uniformity that isn't being implied there?
Mr. Chairman? Cars, vehicles, RVs, boats, those types of things are not subject to sales tax. They're subject to the motor vehicle tax. And if you're asking about uniformity and streamline only deals with sales tax. So we're not out of compliance with that because those are not subject to the sales tax.
Thank you.
Further questions? If not,
pardon me.
Yes, Senator Merchant.
In the case of the reimbursement on the food tax, if a person lives near the border and they may purchase their food items in Minnesota, how does this streamline potentially work for them?
Mr. Chairman. Technically, or by law, by the use tax law, they would owe use tax on those items. But again, if that store in Minnesota became registered for sales tax in South Dakota, and they shipped those things into South Dakota, they would charge the South Dakota sales tax. If you went to Minnesota and picked them up in Minnesota, you wouldn't pay any sales tax. When you brought them back to South Dakota, you would owe the use tax.
And currently, how do you apply or pay for the use tax? And because that doesn't seem to be very readily available, and how do you go through that process?
Mr. Chairman, we have a form out on our website. We don't have the resources available to us at this time to find every single individual who does that. Businesses we do because they have a tax license. We have all sorts of information on our website on use tax. During reviews or audits, we'll pick it up. But for individuals, we don't, unless we have a specific program. One time there was a jewelry store out of state that was bragging that if you came to their state and bought jewelry and they shipped it back to you, you wouldn't owe any sales tax. So we got a customer list and sent them all a bill. We've had a few little programs like that.
Senator Gerstead.
I apologize. I had one more question, if I can now recall what it was. Concerning taxes on, I'm going to have to come back to that.
Well, you ponder that, if I may allow the chairman to ask a question for either one or both of you. What's the history behind how we came up with the rules for either sales tax or use tax? Did we just kind of build our rules as we went along since 1936, or did we have some kind of other states that we that we're comparing on? It's just fairly complicated, and it's a kind of a major piece of accomplishment to get to where we are.
Mr. Chairman, Jan Talley again. Any changes to the sales tax laws since it was implemented, of course, would have been approved by the legislature. Either the state agency brought forward a bill or a constituent brought forward a bill. A lot of the exemptions you see today in the sales tax were what I consider special interest exemptions. Someone brought it forward to exempt a certain portion of the sales tax. Every year we have changes in the sales tax law. Our law is similar to a lot of other states where we exempt governmental entities and sales for resale, and we exempt sales to schools. So those particular exemptions are very similar in other states. But as far as how the use tax and sales tax evolved, it would have been, you know, legislative changes either brought forward by our department, fixes in the law, or exemptions brought forward by some group or a legislator.
Further questions? Senator Gerstead, you're still pondering?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was kind of rethinking my question, and it has to do with when our state contracts work from other states, which I assume occurs quite often. Is it the case then, when we pay those other folks, that we're perhaps losing quite a bit of tax, potential tax dollars, because we're contracting out of state, and then, you know, that money isn't spent then in South Dakota, and so we lose on sales tax and so forth?
Mr. Chairman, Jan Talley again. As far as the question, are you talking about state agencies letting contracts like construction contracts? Construction contracts are bid through the Department of Transportation for state government. You know, all the contractors have an opportunity to bid on those projects. And the bid, of course, determines who is awarded the project. In some cases, the out-of-state contractor is awarded. Some of those projects are specialty-type things that we may not have construction companies in South Dakota that can do it. Some I can think of in particular is the construction of the wind farms. We have out-of-state contractors that come in because we don't actually have construction companies in South Dakota that can do that. But that's all handled through a bid process. When those contractors come in here, they do spend money in South Dakota. You know, they have to stay in South Dakota. They would be purchasing materials and supplies. Of course, some of the materials and supplies come from out of state because of the type of item it is. It isn't manufactured here in South Dakota, so they have to purchase it out of state, ship it into the state, and we get the tax dollars on that through the use tax.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Living along the Minnesota border, I've become quite aware of the fact that the Department of Revenue has started to collect tax on some of the Minnesota farmers that are coming over and farming South Dakota land, and there's getting to be a lot of that done in my area. And I understand that you prorate it out according to the acres they farm in Minnesota and South Dakota, and we collect sales tax on the machinery that they bring across. Now, do we do that on the construction business too? That's my question. Like if a Minnesota road builder comes over, do we collect any sales tax on his equipment that he uses to build South Dakota roads?
Mr. Chairman, Jan Talley again. Senator Peterson, yes, we do. If a contractor comes into South Dakota, we look at the equipment that they've purchased and brought in here. If we're dealing with a contractor in South Dakota licensing them, we'll ask them what equipment they're bringing into South Dakota, and we'll make sure the taxes are paid on that. We'll explain to them how they can report use tax on the tax returns. A lot of those out-of-state contractors are subject to audit by the audit division, And what they'll do is check their equipment lists when they come into the state and make sure that the tax was either paid in their base state or they owe it to South Dakota. So we do check that.
Seeing no further questions, we thank you very much. It's enlightening to hear a report from the agency that we get so much business from. As we proceed to hear bills, I'm going to jump around just a little bit. First of all, I've had to request that we defer Senate Bill 14 to a later meeting, so we will not be hearing Senate Bill 14 this morning. And I would like to, first of all, then I will take Senate Bill 13. If 13 is an act to revise certain provisions regarding the title of real property obtained by a tax deed. And so we will welcome those who are proponents of Senate Bill 13.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. David Wiest of the Department of Revenue and Regulation. Senate Bill 13 is what I categorize as a cleanup bill, and I need to tell you a little bit of the history of why we got to the place we are with Senate Bill 13. In 2007, the legislature commenced and completed in that summer a review of the Department of Revenue and Regulation, and one of the parts of the review is to look over many of the different statutory chapters that the Department of Revenue and Regulation has within the agency. And one of the things that the legislature did is they had about a 70-page bill where they amended a number of sections, getting rid of old archaic language, updating the language, and so forth. And one of the sections was 10-25-12, which is the section we proposed to amend in Senate Bill 13. And what had happened is that they rewrote the first sentence of the bill. Here's what that sentence meant in 2007 before the amendment. And it deals with tax deeds. Tax deeds occur when someone does not pay their real property taxes, the taxes are sold, a tax sale certificate is issued, time passes, and then the person can go ahead and move to obtain a tax deed to the property. That procedure is set forth in part in Chapter 10-25 of our code. Now, what happens after you go through all of the necessary procedural steps to get a tax deed? A tax deed is actually issued to you by, I believe it is, the county treasurer. And then the question is, what does the tax deed give you? Now, in 2007, at present there are two chapters of the code that you can get a tax deed under, Chapter 10-25 and Chapter 10-26. What happened, unfortunately, in 2007 with the bill that was introduced during the 2008 section is we rewrote the first sentence and we inadvertently took out the fact that a tax deed is also issued under Chapter 10-25 as well as Chapter 10-26. So what we are aiming to do here today with this particular bill is to return us back to the status quo that we were in 2007. I should have caught it when we did the omnibus cleanup bill, but I didn't, and it didn't dawn on me until I ran across this last summer, and I thought, well, it's our obligation to go back and return the code to the place that it was before the summer review statutory change. So that is what we're doing with Senate Bill 13. We're returning to status quo. We're just saying that if you have a tax deed either under Chapter 1025 or Chapter 1026, that you get a fee simple estate in the real property. So that is our aim and our goal of this particular bill. And I will mention that whenever anybody does get a tax deed, I have had conversations with a couple of folks that have reminded me that whenever you do get a tax deed, it may be a requirement that you do a quiet title action, which we're not changing at all in this bill. We're just returning to the status quo to make sure that both 10-25 of the code and 1026 are covered. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I will stand by for any questions.
Okay. Are there any further proponents to Senate Bill 13? Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Chuck Schroyer. I'm an attorney here in Pierre, and I represent the South Dakota Land Title Association. That's a group of people that run the abstract offices in your communities and the county seats in every county in South Dakota, and they underwrite title insurance in most cases when real estate is transacted in the state. I think Mr. Wiest has made it very clear that this is simply returning the statute to language that that existed prior to the change that was made in 2008. But I do want to reiterate what he said about the fact that even though the statute will now say, as it does in Chapter 1026, that there's an absolute fee title passed by this deed, that is not actually correct, because our Supreme Court and other courts have ruled from almost day one that that does not necessarily follow due process. That procedure would, if it was the law, perhaps exclude people who had a legitimate interest in the property that simply were never given any notice that this was happening. And so, as Mr. Weiss said, it's almost universal that when one obtains a deed, either through this procedure from the treasurer or from the following chapter, that a quiet title action is going to be necessary in order for them to obtain title insurance. In other words, the underwriting standards that apply to the title that's being insured don't change by reason of any language in this this statute. The chain of title, if it's broken, which it always is in the cases where there's a tax deed, then it's going to require some sort of a court order that directs the title to be changed to the new owner, and that order will only occur when there's been due process by notice given to everybody that might have an interest in that particular property, and that's going to depend on other lien holders and other owners that may be of record that that the treasurer simply was never aware of and were never told that there was any problem with this particular title. So with that, we certainly aren't, we're not really a proponent of the bill, but we're certainly not an opponent. I just wanted to explain that that doesn't really change anything from our perspective. I'll stand by for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Schroyer. Further proponents to Senate Bill 13? Further proponents to Senate Bill 13? If not, are there any opponents to Senate Bill 13? Anyone opposed to Senate Bill 13? Seeing none, does anyone have any questions? Any committee member have any questions of either of the presenters? I guess I would have one, probably perhaps for Mr. Schroyer. Is there a statute of limitations with regard to a tax title? Maybe a better way of saying that, is there a time period that after it had passed, the assumption would be that it's there's no clouds on the title?
Not really. I think that the if there's a person out there or a lien holder, an easement holder, somebody who was never given notice, was unaware that this was occurring, I think they would probably always have a right to come in and make a claim, and that's why the title insurance would be issued. And because of that, the title insurance company probably wouldn't write the policy to begin with unless they were satisfied that a court had, in fact, determined that proper notice had been given. There's a bonding procedure under the quiet title action sections that would require the person who is the proponent to put up a bond to ensure that the notice has, in fact, been given to everybody that might have an interest. So I think that would continue almost perpetually. It's one of those things where you've heard of the cases where somebody has a piece of property and pretty soon the great-great-grandchild comes in and says, well, I was never told about the estate or something. There's always those kinds of errors that might occur, and I don't think there's any statute that would necessarily directly correct that problem without some sort of a proceeding.
Okay. Any further questions? If not, we close the to committee discussion or action.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Nelson.
I move due pass.
Okay, we have a motion for due pass. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Senator Peterson. Any further speaking to the motion? If not, all in favor will say aye. Those opposed say nay, and the secretary will call the roll.
Senator Adelstein, Senator Howey?
Aye.
Senator Gierstead?
Aye.
Senator Maher?
Aye.
Senator Merchant?
Aye.
Senator Nelson?
Aye.
Senator Peterson?
Aye.
Senator Frisley?
Aye.
Senator Hansen?
Aye.
Unanimous.
Okay, the vote is 8-0.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Maher?
Motion for consent.
Second.
Is there a second by Senator Gierstead? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? This will go on the consent calendar. And if there's any questions, let's see. Senator Nelson, could you present that to your caucus? And let's see. Senator Gierstead, would you want to present it to your caucus? Let's see. We have one item left on this morning's agenda, which is Senate Bill 12. And I had a request from Senator Bradford to withhold it. Mr. Krogman, is Senator Bradford in the hall there that you can see? Okay, I think we'll just defer Senate Bill 12 until our next meeting also. And this is a bill that has some involvement with the tribal governments, and he's not necessarily opposed to it, but he just wanted to be able to be present, and so I'll give him that that courtesy. I believe if there's nothing further, let's see. I would take one moment of personal privilege to introduce a very close relative of mine, my son, Seth, who's visiting with us here yesterday afternoon and this morning. So welcome, Mr. Hansen. Good to have you with us. Motion would be in order for adjournment. Moved by Senator Gierstead, seconded by... Senator Merchant, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? We are adjourned.